Before we begin today, we have a very special announcement. We don't normally broadcast hiring announcements on this show because On Deck is honestly hiring all the time and it would get exhausting for the listener. However, today we have a role that we think will be of particular interest to our deep end audience. On Deck's two CEOs, David Booth and Eric Torenberg, who were past guests of the show, are hiring for a role we are calling a researcher in residence. If hired, your key responsibility would be to support David and Eric to help improve their knowledge for the benefit of On Deck. Think of it like a personal trainer for the mind. You help the two learn about current cultural and historical context as relate to the startup and technology industry. In doing this, you will give them the tools and knowledge to understand the future and On Deck's role in building it. This will help shape On Deck's overall strategy in the coming months and years. More information about the role can be found at beyonddeck.com/researcher. Now, on to the episode. Welcome to The Deep End by On Deck, a podcast where visionary builders, creators, and experts discuss world-changing ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kozloff. Let's dive in.
The dirty little secret is that nature is going to be just fine. Because we're just a product of nature. Like, we may not be. We may not be here anymore. Whether it's an asteroid or climate change or geopolitical conflict, we may not exist. But nature is going to be just fine, right? Other planets with nature, other planets with animals. It would be a shame to waste this planet in the incredible diversity and the uniqueness that at least we as of what we know today in the universe is. So it'd be a shame to waste, but nature's going to be just fine without us. And if we don't figure out the harmony between us and nature, well, then I think that, you know, in the end, nature may take a few steps back, but we won't be here to see all the steps that nature takes forward.
At the Deep End, we're creating a space where we skip the surface level and go in depth into ideas that inspire people to build. I'll be your guide as we explore possible futures of internet communities, creator tools, climate tech, longevity, and much, much more. There are no experts in uncharted territory, only pioneers. Deep End invites these trailblazers to turn their experiences into the knowledge and ideas that others need to start their own founder odysseys. Hot off last week's episode about helping extend human life, this episode is about how to bring certain long-gone animals back to life. Joining me this week in the Deep End is Ben Lam, founder and CEO of Colossal Biosciences. Colossal describes itself as a genetic engineering company focused on extinct species restoration through radically new genomic technologies. They have landed a ton of press and attention for their ambitious goal to resurrect a woolly mammoth, or a proxy for a woolly mammoth, in the next few years by sequencing the genome of mammoths and editing genes of their closest living relatives, the Asian elephant. We spend a little time on the hard science of this and discuss how closely this resurrected proxy would be related to the original mammoth. But we also discuss the why, the when, and the obvious, the bioethics. Ben is quick to say there's no silver bullet for climate change or ecosystem restoration. Still, there's a strong conservationist argument for at least learning how we could create genetic backups for species. The Arctic tundra could also potentially see its grasslands return if large animals like the mammoth return to their ancestral homes to eat overgrown bushes and trees. This is an episode that could seem directly out of a sci-fi movie like Jurassic Park, so we get into the hard logistics of how the business of Colossal thinks about funding, capital, and the return on investment in the long term. Ben Lam, welcome to The Deep End.
Thanks for having me. We're excited to chat with you.
I was going to ask a very basic question of why you're doing this, but immediately George Mallory's question of or response to someone asking him, why did you climb Mount Everest? And he said, because it's there. Actually, just I didn't remember it was George Mallory, but that instantly came into my mind. So there's the obvious answer, but what's the deeper answer beyond the fact that this is just really awesome that you want to do this?
Yeah. I don't know. I think there's probably certain things in science that you shouldn't just do because you can. So I don't know if the Everest example is probably right exactly for for our reasoning. I think that just because you can do it doesn't always necessarily mean you should. For us, I'm very, very passionate about emerging technologies. I'm very, very passionate about loss of biodiversity and climate change. And when an opportunity arose to build an emerging technology company that could advance technologies like, multiplex editing for, how it could help just animal and human disease states, to artificial wombs, genetic modifications for other animal or plant use, that got me just insanely excited. That coupled with the ability to, build a de-extinction toolkit, you will, not just for, woolly mammoths and our Arctic elephants, as we like to call them, but also to help existing critically endangered species like the northern white rhino, the Sumatran rhino, the elephant species that are endangered and going extinct, by human hand. That got me pretty excited. So the ability to really build a technology company that could advance a lot of these individual aspects of our overarching mammoth project was incredibly exciting. And then the ability that those technologies could be used not just for mammoths and Arctic rewilding, which we're passionate about, but also for other species, just got us, pretty excited. And, I think that it really kind of justified, the approach of going and raising capital and building a large team to go tackle this.
I want to go back to what you initially said, because there's the very obvious bioethics questions to ask, but I'm a little less interested in them because we're already embracing the premise of doing this. But what things should we not do? Because what's interesting here is if we're having this conversation, it's focused on there are these really big problems. There's biodiversity challenges. Yeah. There's climate change. There's all these things. And the immediate response is, in the face of these big challenges, if we have technology, if we have research, we have ambitious founders, we should do things. What are things we shouldn't do? And if you don't have a specific example, what would your rubric be for saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't use geospatial engineering to address climate change in South America, et cetera, et cetera? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think there's one silver bullet to ecosystem restoration or climate change. I think the only magic silver bullet we have is changing hearts and minds across the whole world. And I think that takes a long time, as we've seen. We've also seen how in, one, political party rises to power, and you could see what's happened in 4 years where, some of those things get set back and whatnot. Some of those climate agendas get set back and whatnot. So I don't think there's one overarching solution to it. I think that there's a myriad of different solutions to it. Ours is around, Arctic rewilding for the purpose of carbon and methane sequestration in the Arctic, which is just one piece of a much more complex system, as well as, then leveraging those technologies to preserve existing small populations and critically endangered or recently extinct, species like the northern white rhino that are essentially functionally extinct. I think that we need to be very, very thoughtful about unintended consequences. So the bioethics side, we actually do spend a lot of time on that, and we spend a lot of time with conservationists, and we're doing everything we can to be radically transparent around these topics. And, what's interesting for us, trying to do this in a thoughtful, disruptive conservation lens is ultimately some of the things that we're working on are longer term in their nature. They have the ability to roll back, if there are unintended consequences to rewilding mammoths. It's not like modifying genetically modifying mosquito or groups of mosquitoes or bees and then letting them into the world. That's much harder to track and roll back. So I think that, where we should set the line as humanity is trying to understand and model out the best as we can from an unintended consequences perspective, and then taking thoughtful steps forward towards our goals while kind of monitoring those unintended consequences. So I'd say probably for us, I think there's a lot of things humanity shouldn't be doing, that some of it we are, some of it we aren't, but one of the things that from our perspective is we need to be very, very thoughtful about the animals that we choose to save, the animals that we choose to resurrect, and then the thoughtful approach to rewilding them back into their habitat, and maybe not start with insects or something that could go wrong and then be very hard to roll back. That it's much easier finding a 1,000-pound animal with a tracker on it than it is, you know, 10,000, you know, genetically modified mosquitoes you put into the wild.
It was funny. In one of the profiles about the company and your raise, you gave the example you just gave, but there's this very vivid picture of, we will know where they are. There will be this giant woolly elephant thing. This isn't.
Yeah, it's not like we're creating woolly mammoth eggs and we're just going to go place them everywhere. And it's some weird scavenger mammoth Easter egg hunt, right? Like we're not doing that. We're being pretty thoughtful. Like the first set of calves will all be, you know, grown in captivity, in tract. We will then look at migrating small herds and working on, you know, herd and population dynamics within, you know, sectioned off parts of the Arctic, most likely Pleistocene Park in northern Siberia and a few other locations that we've identified. And so we'll start there. And then we'll grow. So I think that we can, as long as we, you know, crawl, walk, run in our kind of thinking, then I think we can be pretty smart about how we roll this out and hopefully monitor what those potential unintended consequences are versus just, you know, I read some article around launch where, you know, someone got excited and wrote a story about how they thought that we were going to have like 10,000 mammoths tomorrow, all released into the Arctic, and like no one's going to know where they are. And I was like, that's not exactly how it works or our plan.
Let's just say you probably would have raised quite a bit more money if that was that feasible on the table. But let's, before we get into the mechanics of it, because you made a couple of good references we need to fill the audience in on, I just want to ask the second and last super obvious question we'll get to, which is, why is this time different? We were talking a bit at the start before we started recording about how this really captured people's imaginations. And this story is actually really interesting to me because I remember being in elementary school I don't know why this story is so amazing to people, but I remember being in elementary school in a random buffet with my family in some corner of Portland, Oregon, where my grandmother told me that this was something that was on the table. So this was so exciting for me that I have this very vivid memory of this, but it's been 20 years since then. So why is it different this time? The story always captivates, but why is and once again, it's not like anyone's truly letting anyone down here, but why is this time different than, you know, fourth grade Marshall hearing this story?
Well, I think that, you know, the thing that's most exciting is that fourth grade Marshall, it left an imprint, right? And fourth grade Marshall was excited about it and excited about the possibility in the advancements of science, right? And so we're pretty excited about how the discoveries in our journey, not just the end of the journey of bringing back, you know, the mammoth, but also all the steps along the way. You know, we want to be very transparent, and we're working with some media partners right now that we'll announce hopefully in 2022. And we want to take people along the journey with us so they can actually, you know, not just, you know, hear about it or read about it from a podcast or video, but actually kind of go along the journey with us, because we do think this is something that's so captivating. But the reason why it's so different is, you know, the technologies have just changed and evolved. You know, when Michael Crichton, you know, wrote Jurassic Park and when, you know, gene sequencing and all of that was starting to be a thing that people were theorizing about and talking about. The idea of, you know, the discovery of CRISPR and some of these other gene editing technologies have really, you know, started to deliver on the promise of genetic engineering and genetic modification that we've read about, not just in Jurassic Park, but in a lot of different science fiction and scientific papers over the last, you know, 30 to 50 years. And so we're finally at the point where, one, we have the technology to do it, right? The technologies have gotten better and better. One of the companies that actually spun out of George's lab called eGenesis actually made edits to 42 different genes in pigs. And those pigs, and those edits were made in pigs in order to make the organs, make it more possible for organ transplant to happen without organ rejection. And the global organ trade, there's a huge deficit. So if there's a way to make genetically modified pigs where they can actually save, you know, 9+ human lives with a single pig, that's a pretty interesting, trade-off. I think different people will argue different points of that from a bioethics perspective. The good thing about me and Colossal is that we're not using mammoth parts for humans. So therefore we have I think we have different bioethics that we're obviously dealing with, but the technologies are here, that you can make genetically modified pigs more compatible with that of a human recipient, which is incredible. And I think that those types of technologies that we've seen come out in just the advancements of not just single gene editing, but multiplex editing and editing multiple genes with these technologies has grown significantly, not even in the last 10 years, but in the last 5. So I think that when you have kind of that toolkit, that was really kind of the missing piece, right? Because people had the theory, we've had gene sequencing, you know, used to cost $10 million. Now you can get, you know, genome sequence for, you know, under $1,000. And so when you look at kind of the democratization of some of these technologies and the price points of and the viability of doing the experiments, coupled with, you know, some of the discoveries with gene editing with CRISPR and Cas9 and others, well, you kind of start to have the right, you know, cost benefit analysis plus technology to do it now. And so I'm very confident, so are our investors in this. So hopefully we won't let, you know, young Marshall down or adult Marshall down in our journey. We're confident in the technologies and where we are in the process and the approach. But yeah, I think that, you know, like all technologies, you know, I think science fiction a lot of times can write an interesting roadmap that we start to see advance. Like I'm sure you saw with, at least I felt when I saw the first two SpaceX rockets land, that it's like right out of a 50s, you know, science fiction movie. And now we have, we're on the cusp of, you know, fully autonomous driving cars. I mean, we are living in the future today. And so I do think that, you know, we're now starting humanities building the technologies that are delivering on the promises of science fiction for some time.
So many questions to ask here, so I'm going to do this in no particular order. As a founder in this space, to what level do these really iconic science fiction stories enhance or constrain your thinking? So when you look at this, do you hear Jeff Goldblum in your ear saying, "We shouldn't have done it"? I'm just like, at a more human, I don't want this to sound superficial, but I just wonder, like, that's the question. How much do these enhance, constrain? How does that work when you think about it?
Well, I think that any time that art is made, whether it's literary art or music or paintings or movies, whatever art form that you connect with, it's there to really, you know, evoke an emotion or inspire, right? And so I grew up as a kid watching a lot of movies and reading different comics, and those had some form of imprint on my childhood. So I don't really look at it as limiting. I look at it as inspirational. And so that doesn't mean that we should necessarily do everything that we see on TV or movies or reading comic books. But I think there's interesting lessons learned from it. But I think there's also, you know, it opens the imagination. You know, I think that some of the stuff that Gene Roddenberry did, you know, with, you know, Star Trek and others have started to inspire all kinds of folks. And then you kind of have the ripple effects of other stories. So I'm very pro sci-fi. I'm pretty attracted to, you know, reading as much sci-fi and also watching as much movies and content as I can. Because you always just see new ideas. And I really do feel like humanity's at the cusp of some of these technologies that will kind of deliver on those, that world of sci-fi that we've seen in various movies, in good and in bad ways.
So let's get to the really specific part here, which is that in one of the pieces, you said that the vision is essentially that you will have a living, walking proxy of a woolly mammoth. So let's get to the
I'm glad you said proxy, because you know one of the things that we've tried to be very transparent about, which people not everyone has read, I guess, the fine print on what we're working on, but we are combining the Asian elephant genome and cell line with that of a woolly mammoth. So we like to call them Arctic elephants or functional woolly mammoths, because effectively we are combining, it's more of genetic reconciliation. So what we're not doing is we're not taking woolly mammoth DNA, sequencing it, and then trying to write it from scratch. Like the technologies, we're still a little bit further out from, humanity is a little bit further out from writing full complex organisms like that from scratch. I do think that we'll get there in the not too distant future, but what we are doing is we're actually taking 60 genes and making modifications and putting them into a Asian elephant genome in order to for it to express the phenotype or the physical attributes of a woolly mammoth that make it cold tolerant. So that's things like the small ears, the fat layer, the big shaggy coat that we associate with the woolly mammoth. So for for young, elementary school Marshall, when he or she in the today's age sees that that creature, they'll say, oh, that's a woolly mammoth. So it will be a functional and phenotypical woolly mammoth, but it is a combination of genomes. And what we're, some people sometimes miss what we're working on is that, an Asian elephant is already 99.6% a mammoth genetically today. And so it is the closest living phylogenetic relative on the family tree that, that's related to the mammoths. And so that's why we picked it. That's why we're working with it. That's why the mammoths are a great first species for this, because you have an existing species that's alive, that's actually endangered, that you could actually help by giving them some of the genetic tools of their ancestors. And so it's kind of like the perfect, test case. While hard, it's also an herbivore. So there's a lot of positives to why we can approach it, this way. But I'm really glad you said proxy, because it is a proxy species that we're creating, which is a combination of an Asian elephant and woolly mammoth. Even though it'll look like a woolly mammoth, it is genetically a combination.
Yeah. And because once again, the proxy thing is very key. I read that same 99.6 point. For the audience, though, cosmetically, are they going to be the same? So that's what I'm at. That's basically what I'm asking.
Yeah. So cosmetically, yes. I mean, it will exude all of the traits that we know and love when we think of a woolly mammoth. Its stature, its curved tusk, its dome cranium, its small ears, its shaggy coat. So it'll exude all of the traits that make a woolly mammoth cold tolerant for the most part are what we're focusing on. So you will get the physical look of a woolly mammoth, which it wasn't necessarily the intended goal. It just happens to be a byproduct of making them cold tolerant.
And the key thing here is, what are the implications of everything you just said for the broader conversation around de-extinction? Because the key thing is, we're not reviving the woolly mammoth, given everything you just said. So at a future facing level, what does this mean? Because that's another thing that gets people excited. People get excited, look, it's the woolly mammoth, but that could apply to all sorts of different creatures. What are the implications of what you've just said for that conversation then?
Yeah, I think of de-extinction. I think there's kind of three phases. I think phase one of de-extinction is de-extincting genes that allow us to create and do modifications to a species that give it the tools that it needs or we need, right? So for example, the Asian elephant is endangered. Most of the two leading reasons why are, one, an EEHV, which is a form of herpes that kills about 25% of Asian elephants at the time of weaning, which we hope to eradicate. So that's one of the projects that we've talked about, but we haven't talked enough about it publicly yet. And then the secondly is actually human-elephant conflict. And that's not all poaching. A lot of times poaching is terrible, But it's also a lot of farmers kill elephants. Elephants are highly destructive. And so human-elephant conflict and elephants being in their locations in too close of proximity to humans, coupled with loss of habitat, those are kind of that's kind of like the perfect recipe for loss of the elephant species. So if we were able to genetically modify an Asian elephant, create our Arctic elephants, and then return them to their ancestral domain of the tundra, well, then, you know, not only are we helping in Arctic rewilding and repopulating an ecosystem there, but secondly, you know, we're actually taking existing elephant lineage and putting them in a location where they don't have the same human elephant conflict that exists where they currently live. So I think that there's a lot of benefits to kind of this first phase of de-extinction, which is de-extincting the genes. I think the second phase is where you can get into full read-write. I personally don't see a ton of value in a lot of that. Like if you have a mammoth that is functionally a woolly mammoth, it's cold tolerant, it's able to live and breed and survive and help reshape the Arctic, and it has the ability to and you made the modifications to make it obviously cold tolerant so that it can live and thrive up there. Well, then I don't understand really the full purpose of outside of just the prestige of rewriting a species from scratch. I don't really see the reason for that if you can combine them. I think the second phase of de-extinction is, which I think people are excited about, is writing something from scratch. And so maybe if you don't have a species that could act as either a surrogate or act as a close enough relative to make modifications to, then I think that becomes more interesting. And then the third is just the world of synthetic biology of when can we create organisms from scratch that have the attributes that we're looking for. And I think an example of that is, could we make cows that are more efficient or that produce less methane? Could we go create fish that populated at a different scale so that we can repopulate the oceans? Could we make modifications to corals and whatnot? So I think there's a lot of benefit that will come from synthetic biology over time.
So when we've been dancing around this, but what is the benefit of having mammoth proxies walking around in the Arctic? Because you've alluded to this, there's a key thing. There is like a broader benefit beyond just the let's just say the exhibitionist part that tends to attract people. What is the positive sum, like actual really like idealized version of this that will emerge from this status?
Yeah, so I'd say twofold. There's a conservation aspect and there's a climate change aspect. From a conservation aspect, I think I've touched on this. It's that if we can create populations of elephant, of the elephant lineage, in different parts of the world, that would be really, really helpful to preserving existing species. In addition to that, the second part is actual climate change. So if you look at the Arctic elephants and you look at the historical mammoth steppe that existed, it used to be filled with this grassland known as the Arctic grasslands. And it's way more efficient from a carbon sequestration perspective than the existing tundra that exists today. And there's a ton of carbon and methane captured and trapped in the Arctic that is, you know, significantly more than what you see even in a tropical rainforest. Most people don't think of that. Think of the Arctic this way. But the way that it worked in the Arctic is that as animals die and as plant life dies, it gets trapped by a layer of snow and ice, and then that just continues to compile. Whereas in like a rainforest, you have more of a continuous nitrogen carbon cycle, and so you've got so much trapped carbon as well as methane. And so and what most people don't realize is that, because we hear a lot about CO2, but methane is actually about 30 times worse in the atmosphere. It could cause, you know, what happened on Venus, which is a runaway greenhouse effect. And so it's pretty, you know, carbon emissions into the atmosphere and carbon accumulation is pretty bad. And then you layer on methane, well, then, you know, it's definitely a pretty bad scenario. And the Arctic, you know, has it's the most area where there's the most trapped methane on the planet. And so if we have the ability, there's been some interesting studies that have been done over the last decade and a half around taking existing species like oxen, like reindeer, like certain types of horses, reintroducing them into cleared land. And this is an area known as Pleistocene Park in northern Siberia, where the Nikita and Sergei Zimov have worked really, which are two Russian ecologists that have worked very, very closely with the Russian government, and they've done all types of monitoring of soil, of carbon release, of methane release, and of temperatures. And what they found is that, you know, if you can add a large number of cold tolerant megafauna back into the area, well then you actually have the ability to, one, through grazing and through stampeding, you actually lower the temperature. So there's been really interesting studies even in the Sahara where there's migratory patterns of elephants. It actually packs and keeps even the dirt in Africa colder. And so you have that effect. There's also the albedo effect that happens with the amount of light reflection from light that's coming in and gets reflected off of sunlight versus off of the coniferous trees that are currently there. The trees that are there are small. They're actually not very efficient at carbon sequestration. They're dark. They actually absorb heat and actually disseminates down through the roots. It actually breaks up the soil and breaks up the tundra. And so the current ecosystem just is degraded, given that there's been a large number of cold tolerant megafauna that have been removed from that, over the last 10,000 years. And so elephants are incredibly great at modifying their environments, and they're great at knocking down trees. They're great at helping restore balance to their ecosystems that they survive in. And so there's been interesting studies on that the Zimovs and others have done on not just reintroducing cold tolerant megafauna, but also if you reintroduce large populations of cold tolerant elephants or Arctic elephants or mammoths, not only could they be helpful in all the ways we've described, but they're also very efficient at knocking down trees, and they actually love to do it. And so there's a huge opportunity for us to reintroduce them and to help with the topics that we discussed initially on, just a few minutes ago, but then also for them to help geoengineer the location and help bring back the Arctic grassland by uprooting the trees and shrubs. And they're insanely efficient at this, and they love to do it. And so what's interesting is, like, while we're working on it really for the purpose of conservation, our long-term impact will be in their true rewilding of the species and in creating interbreedable herds that can help reshape the Arctic back into mammoth steppe, which was a much more efficient carbon sink and methane suppression ecosystem than what currently exists today. So you kind of get these two benefits, right, of saving elephant populations and other cold-tolerant megafauna that we may try to modify over time, and then also Arctic rewilding. So so that's why, the mammoth is for us a perfect species, because we get all of the benefits without, much negativity to it.
You know, it's funny, everything you said about why elephants are excellent fits, or why an elephantine species would be an excellent fit for the Arctic, are the reasons why, to your point earlier, they're a disaster in South Asia, where there are farmers or there are humans who have their own ecosystems. So that's just really worth noting. Here's something I'm trying to understand here. And once again, I realize there are multiple reasons to pursue the proxy mammoth here, but If the goal is avoiding like catastrophic climate change, so let's say you're particularly attracted to that point, my take would be all this science stuff is great, but what we should probably just do is just grab every single ox we can and send it north tomorrow. Because, and we'll get into this when my question about like the actual timeline, you say this, it's, 4 to 6 years for the process that you're funding to work. It's then another 13 years for sexual maturity. Then, you've got breeding, and then it goes, just tie those two questions and processes together.
I see where you're going, and because there's a lot there, but what I will tell you is it's a complicated answer, because if you doing nothing, we know what that results in. And so we are not, as I mentioned earlier, the silver bullet that's going to cure and solve all climate change. I think that the way we solve it, besides changing hearts and minds, as I mentioned earlier, is just, it's a tapestry of technologies that, women and men across the globe work on, from solar to algae-based systems to recycling systems to new forms of plastic and everything else. All the way to, to Arctic elephants. So I think there's a lot of room in this. And I really do think it, You know, the old saying, it takes a village. I think it takes the world to really, you know, solve this problem. And I feel like we're getting there. I think we're starting to, humanity's starting to wake up. And so elephants have been proven to be pretty effective climate modifiers starting at about age six. And so that's still, to your point, you know, it's, you know, we're thinking that our first calves will be 4 to 6 years. And I can explain that timeline in more detail if we need to. It's about we're about 18 months away from to 24 months away from viable embryos. It just takes 22 months for gestation of an elephant. That's just what biology takes. So you're already at 4 years. If you throw in some debugging time, I come from the software world, right? So thinking about debugging, then you get to 4 to 6 years, right? And so I think that's a realistic timeline. Everyone keeps asking us if we can go faster, but there are some things we just can't speed up, unfortunately. In parallel, you know, it takes 6+ years to get to where I think they're effective. So I think you're looking at 10 years. But with that said, we could just pursue, if we were doing this from a novel perspective, we could just go pursue surrogacy and count that as our win, right? And have a small herd of calves and say, we did it. We changed the world. That's amazing. But we're really pursuing artificial wombs and production level technologies that will allow us to manufacture our Arctic elephants at the scale of which we need to make that impact. We would like to have, different vintage years of calves on a rollout basis that could be, mass grown. And then you've got to go through the training and logistics of rewilding. If you look at what happened with, they used sock puppets and kind of primitive robotics for California condor, we can do similar things like this. Elephants are very smart. They're very social. They actually adapt very easily. So we think that introducing them to new herds would be very, very fast. And so I think that the training process, you don't have to train an elephant, you know, how to knock down trees. You don't have to train an elephant. A lot of that's kind of built in. And so for us, I think the timeline is probably till we get to our first calves truly in the wild will probably be, call it 8 to 10 years. But I think that we ramp pretty fast, you know, from there. And I think in parallel, you know, I think there's lots of conservation aspects that people can do, like supporting the Zimovs and supporting, there's some great scientists at Cambridge and others that are doing Arctic rewilding projects. But there's also like new technologies that are like talking about biodegradable plastics. And there's new technologies around using algae and other fuel sources. So I don't think you shouldn't just fund our initiative or send as many oxen as you can up north. But I think there's lots of initiatives that people, if they want to get involved with, if they look impact investing, and then also just incredible nonprofits are doing so much right now. And so I really, it kind of gives me faith in humanity for what everyone's doing. So that's kind of our path, right? And that's kind of our timeline. Like any technology or private company that I've built, you know, we'll raise subsequent rounds of capital that allow us to grow and scale at a faster rate over time.
Yeah, and two questions related to capital. So one, like, how does this thing make money? You gave a useful metaphor of relating this to like the Apollo program. It says that there's this massive upfront research development work. And then over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, there are all these spin-off technologies. But could you just explain that metaphor in the context of what you're doing?
Yeah, for sure. I do like that metaphor because, you know, things outside of Tang came out of the Apollo program, right? Like GPS, and like I can't get anywhere without my phone. And like the technologies that even allowed this, came out of the Apollo program. And so, you know, that, I mean, there are trillion-dollar industries that have come out of that moonshot, literal moonshot. So if you break down the technology set into software, hardware, and wetware being like what happens in the lab, those are tools like CRISPR and other gene editing tools that, you know, we're working on and that we're advancing that can make multiplex editing or editing multiple genes at the same time better, more efficient. We're also doing a lot of work in stem cell reprogramming. So how do we turn different stem cells back into its induced pluripotent state and then reprogram those stem cells into tissue samples and tissue types that we want them to exude, right, and whatnot. So I think that there's a lot of biology advancements that can help both animal and veterinarian healthcare, as well as human healthcare. And I think all of those could be quite large. I think there's also, I'm a big believer that, you know, software over time eats everything. Being a software entrepreneur, of course, I have that religion in me one way or the other. And then secondly, I think that, you know, if you take that mentality to biology, I think we're just at the cusp of where AI and biology kind of intersect and where software eats biology over time. So I do think that I do think there's going to be some pretty interesting advancements coming at the intersection of gene editing and software, which I think that we have the right kind of multidisciplinary team in order to achieve that. And I think that that has massive ramifications to human healthcare and drug discovery and cancer research. And then I also think that, you know, artificial wombs, which sound like science fiction, they've actually done, there's actually been incredible work that's come out of Philadelphia Children's and others of the work of Alan Flakes and others with the biobag and late stage artificial wombs, which could be used for preemies and other use cases. But I think that full term artificial wombs could be massively helpful for everything from growing 100 northern white rhinos in the lab and saving a small population species, all the way to giving, you know, couples choice on when and how they create a child, or folks with, you know, endometriosis or others that don't have the ability to have children, right, and have to lean on surrogacy, right, and so this kind of gives them additional optionality long term. So I think that each one of those buckets creates an incredible amount of potential for return for our investor base. But I think it's also really important to align our goals with our investors. Our investors are very long-term focused. They're not, you know, betting it all on red at the casino with us, right? They're excited about us, right? They're excited about us, but they're very long-term investors. So we did a lot of work on finding the right types of investors and curating long-term focused investors that have a passion for these technologies, that have a passion to make an impact, that understand what's going on with the world and have a passion for biodiversity. So I think it's not just about our long-term return potential or threshold, which I think that I've answered, but I think it's also about finding the right types of investors mm-hmm. that really care about that impact as well as the return, but are the right level of patient capital.
You know, it's interesting. When I'm hearing your description of patient capital and we're invoking the Apollo program, what conceptually do you think is the difference between capital that comes from, let's say, like government research dollars and the type of investors that you're looking at? Because, you know, in the context of government, you know, the Apollo program is funded the way it was national security reasons, obviously, but yeah. Let's put that to a side, right? There's a certain type of model that government funding is good to do. What do you think the mix is when you're approaching problems like the one you're describing?
Yeah, I mean, look, we would happily take government funding as well. We haven't applied for grants or anything because we've had so much success in a short period of time in the private sector. And so we haven't really pursued government funding, but I think it's something that we could. You know, I think that, you know, anytime that you have government or academia solely, I think you're on those types of timelines. When you are on private funding timelines, I do think that you can accelerate it. If you look at what, you know, SpaceX and Blue Origin and Virgin Orbits and Virgin Galactic have already done for the broader space industry, not only have they helped democratize access to low Earth orbit and beyond, they've also, you know, it's like the whole sharpening each other's sword analogy, right? It's like, look at what Lockheed and Boeing and DLA and others are having to do, and what they have to move at a different clip of innovation that they've historically been moving at to keep up with these new entrants into the market that are already the prominent players, right? Overnight, or seemingly overnight, if you look at the historical timeline. So I think that there's different benefits and that you get from both. Obviously, you get the grant money, and you don't give up equity, and you have different kind of return thresholds or zero return thresholds coming from the government or government debt or loan. Whereas with traditional venture capital, you have different expectations. But I think that those expectations help drive the right type of scrutiny on your goals, on your timelines, on your hiring. So I think that there's a benefit that really comes from partnering with the private sector, on these types of initiatives. And I think we've seen it, like we've seen it with the space industry, right? Like, look how far the space industry has come because of private funding in the last, 15 years. It's a completely different industry.
Something I'd love to hear from you on is, you made this reference to, software, eating everything, and you being a founder who started in the software space. Can you just discuss at a conceptual level the difference between attacking software problems and attacking these types of like synthetic biological ones? Because the interesting metaphor, it was a recent guest on the show. I apologize to them for forgetting which guest this was, but their point was, if you think of, let's say it's the year 2008, and you're saying, hey, like, I want to make Airbnb, or I want to attack Uber. At a key level, like, none of the founders in those spaces knew anything about the hotel industry. They didn't know anything about the taxi industry. And that was actually an advantage, because at a core level, it was a software programming challenge. And that made up for the lack of deep, and it let you throw away legacy industry assumptions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But here, this is entirely different. This isn't purely a question of how many, 10x engineers can you hire in the next week. So can you just speak about operating these two spaces?
The biggest similarity I see is it's still systems thinking. So even though some of those folks didn't know anything about the taxi industry or the hotel industry, or my background, and I have zero background in biology, right? You can still start to understand. I think a lot of great software and hardware engineers are really good systems thinkers. What I found in biology so far is that you'll have just incredible specialists that are focused, that solve this incredible thing, and they win the Nobel Prize, or they win, or they get 10 papers published on this one nuanced thing that's incredibly important for that thing. But how does that relate to a larger system? And I don't see enough of that being, at least in my earlier time, I hope all the biologists don't come at me over this, but I don't see enough people that are focused on on kind of the generalized system. I think that one of the things that George Church is incredible at is he's both. He's actually a systems thinker just naturally, and then he's very good at solving incredibly detailed problems. So that, I think he's a true national treasure, both from an innovation perspective and a innovation and biology perspective. And so I look at these things like before this. My last company is focused on AI at the intersection of critical infrastructure, space, and defense. I'd never done anything in space, never done anything in defense before that. But I really look at it as, my goal is to look at the entire system, set the vision, and then hire the best people, and then give them the resources they need to succeed, right? And so I now understand enough about the system that we're trying to create, and then I can then take a step back and say, understanding what the biology system looks like, understanding what the timelines look like, what team do I need to solve that, and then what teams do I need for really scale? And I think that's where software really play in system thinking from a software perspective really plays a critical role for me in my entrepreneurial journey, is because it's not just about solving the problem or building the team to solve the problem. It's also then understanding how that scales, and how that scales in the fabric of the society that we live in today, and the fabric that we want to live in 5 years from now. And so I don't look at building an artificial womb or building a mammoth that different than building a software company, because I really think it's about understanding what your vision is in the system that you're trying to affect is, and then putting the resources around that system and processes around those resources to create kind of that system outcome. At least it's just how I think about the world.
And two last bigger questions here. So one would be, just give us a quick vision statement. We have the vision statement for, let's say, the climate side and the tundra and all those parts specifically, but the derivative technologies from this process, CRISPR, artificial wombs, describe at a human level, ideally 30, 40, 50 years from now, what our world could look like if we get those derivative technologies the way we want to, right? In the same way that you said, we have this conversation over Zoom, well, Riverside. Yeah. I have my cell phone here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because of the space program. Describe the world that we could live in.
Yeah, I think that we could live in a world where even if not all consumer behavior has changed, we could have genetically created byproducts like plastics that are 100% biodegradable, that are made out of some form of synthetic biology, right? That were designed or grown, right? And so if they're grown, that's even more natural and more organic, that's less power. They'd be completely organic. You can completely throw them away and not have any ramification from that. I think that we could have, you know, genetically modified algae and algae-based systems that could replace or modify all HVAC systems in the world to provide cleaner oxygen in buildings, and then the byproduct be biomass that we could then, you know, either refine and create cleaner fuel types with with that biomass, or dehydrate it and use it as a food source or a substitute for fertilizers and whatnot. I think that we can make genetically modified plants that are more efficient at carbon sequestration. Then we make genetically modified corals that can survive in the different temperature and salinities and how we've affected the oceans, and we can help those reef systems thrive again. I think we can make genetically modified animals that are more efficient for human needs, but are also more at the production scale that humanity requires. Because remember, humanity is better at being humans than we are at doing anything else, unfortunately. And sometimes we're too efficient at it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that we could have a world where, you know, our kids or grandkids could see, you know, species, thriving, and not just read horror stories about the last two northern white rhinos, but they could read stories about how there's very similar to the American bison and buffalo, where, you know, we went down to a couple hundred only, and now there's that tens of thousands back. Right. And so, like, what if, you know, kids could go through a park and not just see a picture of this was the dodo or this was the northern white rhino that existed and it died off in 2022. Instead they drive through something, or they see a special where there's just, you know, herds of 50 running across the plain. So I believe in that. I think that genetically modified enzymes to eat plastics in the ocean. Like, I think that if we do our job right at Colossal, and other biotechs and other synthetic biology companies do their right, then I think that we could have a more human natural world intersection through these technologies, and that's something that's pretty awesome, right? And I think that hopefully that will even pave the way for technologies that, you know, companies like SpaceX and others need over time for off-world work, and I think that we can even play our role in the future in evolving space race.
And to wrap us up, and I asked this question, it's not perfectly coherently formed, but it just came up reading all the press about your work. What do you think nature is? And what I mean by that question is, I was thinking about this, and I was sort of thinking, this isn't natural, but the, you know, asteroid that killed the dinosaurs, like, that isn't natural. And, you know, nature is not this thing that we could just anthropomorphize. The humans who killed off the last of the men, what is the real difference between just nature in its, just by itself doing what, just, because I think this is where people, some of the bioethics questions are useful, some of them aren't particularly helpful, but I think they all stem from a real lack of conceptualization around, like, what is natural versus what isn't natural. So I just love your framework for thinking through that. It doesn't have to be particularly coherent.
Yeah, I think that it's kind of like work-life balance, right? Like, a lot of people will talk about work-life balance and they'll think it's a separation. But, you know, I read this great piece by, I forgot who wrote it, about work-life integration and work-life harmony. I think, you know, we're products of nature. You know, everything that we have and we are is a product of nature. And I think there's a lot of time that, you know, both different parts of various political parties and different worldviews really kind of, you know, even some conservationists actually will split us. They're like, well, this is us and we're bad, and in nature we have to just take care of. And then I think that there's other groups of people that look at it completely opposite. And they say, well, nature's here to serve us. And really, we have to look at it more in harmony, because the dirty little secret is that nature's going to be just fine. Because we're just a product of nature. Like, we may not be. We may not be here anymore, whether it's an asteroid or climate change or geopolitical conflict. We may not exist, but nature is going to be just fine, right? Other planets with nature, other planets with animals. It would be a shame to waste this planet in the incredible diversity and the uniqueness that at least we as of what we know today in the universe is. So it'd be a shame to waste, but nature is going to be just fine without us. And if we don't figure out the harmony between us and nature, well, then I think that, you know, in the end, nature may take a few steps back, but we won't be here to see all the steps that nature takes forward. So I think it's about finding that harmony that a lot of people like to politicize on, that we just don't need nature or we're separate from nature. But we've really got to find how we, you know, collaborate with nature. And I think that's something that is critical, because climate change and combating climate change isn't about saving humanity. It isn't about saving the planet. It's about allowing us to coexist. And that's something that I don't think enough people focus on.
Willie Rose said, Ben, thank you so much for joining. I would ask for a piece to reference people to, but there are literally too many. So we'll include a couple good ones we enjoyed in the show notes and everything. Thank you so much for joining us on The Deep End.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us in The Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.